Welcome to the Weekly Leader Podcast. This is a special Emotionally Intelligent Leadership edition. And I have with us today Scott Allen, who's a co-author of that book, Emotionally Intelligent Leadership, A Guide for College Students. Scott, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Peter. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great today. Thanks, Scott. And I really enjoyed the last episode we did with Min Tree. He was a great guest, and that actually has been downloaded quite a bit, that episode, and I'm looking forward to this one too.
Okay, so today we have Bijan Amadian with us, and he is a leader at the University of British Columbia. Welcome aboard, Bijan.
Thanks, Scott.
So tell us about your role at UBC and how you serve the university.
At UBC, I serve as the president of the Central Student Society. We have a population of more than 46,000 students at our Vancouver campus. And our student society has pretty much plays two major roles. One of them is running businesses, 14 businesses where we hire about 400 students, and then the profit from those businesses serve the student government arm, which does advocacy work and provides the student services across campus.
Wonderful, wonderful. And now, each week we really like to learn how our guests became interested in leadership and serving in the capacities that they do. So would you tell us your story? When was the first time you thought, you know, that's something I'd like to do? Grade school, or was it in high school?
I came to UBC as an international student in engineering, and you know, one of the first time I was inspired to do something you know, that resembled leadership was watching my orientation leader help us with our transition to from high school to university, and at that point I had just come from a new country. English was my second language, it still is, and I didn't know anyone, and so taking part in leadership was one of the ways that helped me transition to a different culture, a different environment, and helped me meet new people and sort of figure out what it was that I wanted to do with my career. So, for example, I originally started off in engineering, and soon through the leadership involvement that I had, I learned that I liked problem solving. That's why I was in engineering, but I liked it more when it involved people as opposed to devices, and that's how I then ended up in law school.
Talk to us about where you came to UBC from and even some of the differences that you noticed culturally when it comes to leadership. What are some of those that you've observed over the years?
I came from Middle East. Had grown up in Iran until I was 16, and then finished my last 2 years of high school in Dubai before I came to Vancouver. In terms of differences in leadership, I can use entrepreneurship as an example. I grew up in a very entrepreneurial family, and in Dubai, I would see my father did a lot of business transactions, purely based on trust, and there was little paper trail of things that sometimes was exchanged, whereas in Canada, just given how large the system is, you know, that wasn't the case, and there were lots of paper trails, and there were lots of things that had to be taken care of. So things were done more independent of trust in Canada, whereas things were based a little bit more on trust in Middle East, I found, at the time.
Wonderful. And, you know, today I think a little bit of our focus is going to be on the EIL capacity of capitalizing on difference, which is mm-hmm. really about building on assets that stem from differences between people.
Mm-hmm.
It suggests that differences are seen as assets, not barriers, and that there's any number of differences that exist within human populations. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Vancouver, 50% of the population, English is not their native language.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
How have you experienced that in your time in Vancouver? And in your current role, how do you have to capitalize on differences? It would seem on a daily basis.
Exactly. It is on a daily basis. In fact, at UBC, when we did a study, we learned that about half of our students don't speak English at home. When you look at my group of executives that I work with four vice presidents. Every one of them speaks a second language, and we come from different cultures. We come from different upbringings, and we have different types of approaches when it comes to how we get things done, how we manage our time, how we resolve conflict. That's a big issue, and how we communicate with each other. What I have found is important is to sort of take some time back and recognize that there are differences and find out what those differences are and be able to articulate what they are, just so that you can start normalizing them and as opposed to personalize them. And then the next step is, okay, so if these are the differences, what kind of a strength does this person bring to the group, and where do they fit best, and then sort of start from there.
That's wonderful, and I think you've just highlighted a couple really strong hallmarks for successfully leading a group with differing worldviews or mindsets. Can you think of any other hallmarks that you would say you've used to navigate some of those differences?
Personally for me, especially in student leadership, people who get involved, because it is a political position, you have to go out, get elected. People come with a lot of passion for what they want to accomplish and what they have promised to their constituency. Being able to put that put differences aside and be able to trust that people are here for the right reasons. They're well intentioned. It's just different ways of doing things. I think is the biggest challenge. So I know we've talked about your book, Leadership and Emotional Intelligence. That's one of the biggest pieces in dealing with differences. Is you have to be emotionally intelligent. First of all, yourself, and be able to not let that passion that drove you to the office drive everyone else crazy. Yeah.
And I imagine that's a challenge, because you have a number of people who are very passionate and have their own stakes in the game, so to speak. Who would some of your constituents be?
The five executives that get elected are elected by the 46,000 students. So that's our constituents.
Great. And do you have roles where you're working with administration as well and on that end of the spectrum, getting work done there?
Yeah, exactly. So I have one of my vice presidents deals with the university mainly. Another one deals with government, federal and provincial. Then one deals with strictly with budgets and finances. And then the fourth one deals with all the internal matters in the AMS.
Great. Well, and I imagine in the time that you've been in this role, and it's been about 6 months, correct? Potentially maybe a little bit longer.
Since February 12th.
Okay. So what have you learned about yourself? I mean, at times I will write about what I call edge experiences. And so an edge experience is really any time that you kind of get that feeling in your stomach where you're not really sure how things are going to turn out. And it might be that you're speaking in front of 1,000 people, or it might be that you're about to take on a new task where it's unsure as to how it will turn out. I call that an edge experience, and I imagine you found yourself in an edge experience when tasked with leading 46,000 undergraduates. And I have great
undergraduates, actually.
Undergraduates. And I have great admiration for that. And what have you learned about yourself in that process? What are some of the greatest...
It's 46,000 graduate and undergraduate students. I think one of the things that I have learned is that I, naturally, like everyone else, I do have the fight or flight response, naturally. And mine is usually the fight and not the flight. I usually like to stay in the ring and continue the fight. And one of the things that I have learned is the tremendous value that that cooling off brings to resolving things. And so that's one of the things that I have, you know, personally, we have personally done in our team, is that we have now made that a systematic thing, that once we get to a point where we're just not making any progress, and it's obvious, let's just sleep on it for 2, 3, 4, sometime a week and come back to it. And it's remarkable how that makes a huge, huge difference, and how then you revisit the whole issue, and then you can come to an agreement.
Hmm. What else?
Well, these are political positions, so naturally, one of the things that you have to accept is that you're not going to make everybody happy. There are lots of times where folks write things about me or draw things about me, for that matter, that I have learned to accept as part of the democratic process and learn from. But you have to then trust yourself that you look at that, you learn from it, you listen to it, but then you move on and don't personalize it.
That's great, and I think you've hit on something that's really important about leadership, is that it's not all tiptoeing through the tulips all the time. There's real ramifications for taking a stand on an issue or marching forward in a direction you believe in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's this quote from Murphy that if you try to make everybody happy, nobody will like it. That's true of leadership too.
Exactly. Peter, what questions do you have? What's coming to mind for you?
Well, first of all, you make it sound so easy, Bijan, and obviously it isn't. There's some kind of takeaway for us there. But I'm interested in your day-to-day. You say 46,000 graduates and undergraduate students and 14 businesses, and those businesses employ a number of people, and they generate revenues for student government. What's your day to day? What do you do all, as a president? How does that impact your day?
So the way that we manage that scale of work is essentially through teamwork, and we have a hierarchy of teamwork. My direct reports are the four vice presidents who get the things done, and a general manager who's a permanent staff who doesn't turn over every year, just the way that executives do, and he oversees and manages the businesses. And so those six are my direct reports. Now, the way that I describe my role on a day-to-day basis is that I do two things. I help those direct reports get things done, and then I make that thing look good to everyone else. And so part of my job is PR, is making sure that I communicate that to students, whether it's through blogging, whether it's through interviews with media, the campus media, whether it's, doing a podcast like this, is to make sure that people know that there's certain kind of projects that we are undertaking. And we've been recently looking at ways that then we can make this a two-way communication, is that we get some feedback back from students on how we are doing. So this year, for example, one of the first things that we did is it was communicating to students our strategic plan for a year. We put together a plan with the 40 projects that are under that are ongoing, and posted them on the website so people can give feedback on them and also say which projects they're interested in. And we've had some uptake from the students that have come forward and say, you know what, I really like that project that UBC's Got Talent. It's a really, really interesting thing. How do I get involved with that? Those are, my day is pretty much two things: overseeing the direct reports and public relations.
And then, and we can't forget that you are a dual major, right? You're in law school and going for an MBA in business school. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah, doing the joint law and MBA program.
Okay, so you remind me of the saying of you want something done, give it to a busy person. How much is this, does this leadership role, time-wise, demand of you?
It is a full-time job. I am required to work 40 hours a week. It's a paid full-time job, and it is obviously not possible to be doing school full-time. So during this period, I only take 3 credits a semester. So I, you know, when you take on a position like this, you essentially postpone graduation by a year because you want to put more focus on learning outside the classroom for, you know, a period.
Wow, wow. You shouldn't really have to postpone it for a year. This seems like probably more lessons learned in this year than you probably have in, up to date in your life.
Absolutely, and I find it fascinating, especially given my business degree, to be able to apply some of the things that I learn in class sometime on the very same day at work.
Yeah, well, fascinating. Your website is also interesting, and I hope you don't mind. We'll link to it from the show notes of the podcast. But it's a very positive. You create a very positive feeling when you go to that website. And I was just wondering, in your campaign for president's position, was the message you delivered in your website is certainly very positive. Were the other – those you were campaigning against is equally so, or how's that? I know in politics, at least in the United States, so often now we see so much in the way of negative advertising, but you really – I wanted to vote for you, so.
That's actually really interesting because I was definitely watching some of the coverage, and you know, I think here in Canada, a lot of folks that were talking about that being one of the differences. I mean, we do focus on the other person to some extent, but I think one of the differences here, not just in campus politics, but in municipal, provincial, and federal politics, is that people tend to focus more on themselves here, that especially than what I saw in the recent elections in the U.S., where the focus seems to be a lot on the other person and the other candidates and how you know people shouldn't elect them. On campus, the negative campaign will not get you votes. Pretty much, I would say that, you know, one of the things that I have learned, and I've run in 6 campaigns at UBC, president was the 6th one, was that the underdog always wins. And if you want to be the underdog, you don't want to attack the other person. As soon as you attack the other person becomes the underdog, and you lose votes and you lose respect from the voters very, very quickly. So that's an important cultural thing that I have definitely learned here.
Very wise words. And the other thing that really intrigued me on the website is that you are a dancer. And I was just wondering, what has dance done for you, your practice of leadership or your thoughts about leadership? Anything?
Well, it's been a place that I have gone to in order to find some relief from the day-to-day stress. And I think that is something that I used to underestimate, the value of exercise. Being physically fit has a direct link to being emotionally and mentally fit. So dance does that. It brings that exercise and that physical fitness for me. But it also gives me an environment to explore my creativity and explore a different part of my brain. And I've come to, you know, believe that there are the two skills that you really need to have in order to exercise good leadership. You have to be able to be analytical and be able to problem solve, but you also have to be really creative. And once you've analyzed something, is how do you come up with creative outside the box solutions that then you can live with and others can live with. And, you know, I've come to believe that the creative side of your brain can develop in outside of the work environment. And I think dancing is where I keep developing the creative side of my brain. So I call myself creative and I apply that creativity at the workplace.
Excellent.
I think that is one of the most eloquent responses to a question I've heard in a long, long time, Bijan. I think that was just beautiful how you captured and really synthesized that question. I think you're exactly right. Problem solving and working through issues, but doing so in a creative way and in a way that's outside the box will really make all of the difference. I mean, you can look to a number of world leaders you could look to Gandhi, who was very creative in how he chose to solve the problem he was trying to alleviate for the Indian people.
Right.
So Peter oftentimes will ask this question, and speaking of creativity, I'm going to steal your thunder a little bit, Peter. How have you used social media to connect with constituents and to elevate your platform? How, speaking of creativity, has that been a piece of your toolbox?
Absolutely. And in fact, social media has changed the face of how we run campaigns at UBC. I do remember a time where posters were a key way that we communicated messages, and you know, the number of posters that we print at elections like that have substantially decreased because, you know, you communicate to people online, especially through Facebook, especially through Twitter, and through your website. Now, because at UBC, our voting has been completely shifted to be online as well. You know, that's also changed the dynamic. But going back to your question, how we use social media, we use social media in sort of a couple of ways. One is to communicate to our constituencies what are some of the things that are happening, give them updates to Twitter posts and things like that. We also use social media as a way to interact with our constituency and have some way of back and forth with them, just so they interact with our organization. They tell us what are some of the things that are important to them. It gives me a chance to feel the pulse. So there have been times, and I think this is a very important leadership skill to have, is to you have to know when you have to pull the plug on something. Mm-hmm. There have been times where I have pull the plug on a project after I have noticed through social media that it doesn't have the uptake that it needs to have with the students. And sometimes I have moved a lot, you know, pushed a lot harder on a project at a lot faster rate when from social media I have seen that it has a strong uptake with students and it can happen at a lot faster rate.
Is it a given that you can get their attention through social media, or is it still hard work?
Most of them, yes, we can. We can certainly get their attention through social media. Most of you know, I'd say most of UBC students are on Facebook.
Yeah. Bijan, you kind of addressed this, I think, but I want to just throw this back out at you again. Has there been any single event or any person in your life, or one of each even, that along your leadership journey has significantly influenced the way you exercise leadership or your leadership style?
Mm-hmm. I'd say the most transformative event for me was immigrating to Canada, I was determined to succeed in a new country and in a new culture and a new environment, and so that strong will, I think, was a big drive behind me to accept that there will be times I will fail and to accept what Edison once said, that I haven't failed, I have found 10,000 ways it didn't work. It was a big motto for me. And so the drive that I had came from the event of immigrating here and realizing, you know what, I need to work hard to make things happen. In terms of a person, I've looked up to many people, some of them alive and some of them not. I did engineering physics for my undergrad, so I used to look up to Einstein and collect quotes from him a lot. when I started leadership, there were several people that I look up to, and some of them were leaders in the human rights community, and looking at what some of the sacrifices they have made for the good of the society are sort of the kind of folks that I have looked up to.
Okay. And in your life, I mean, this is a big move you made, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked a little bit about your dad and his business experience.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, three younger sisters.
Three younger sisters. And then so along the way, I mean, what was really the catalyst that caused you to make this decision to be an international student, to come to Canada? Was it a family move, or was this something you personally, you know, was it an educational decision that you made, I want to go to study somewhere else?
It was primarily, an educational decision. And at first I moved here alone by myself, and then family came a few years later. And the thing, the biggest catalyst was that I wanted to get a good quality education, and I wanted to live in a country that valued civil rights. That was a big issue for me. Dancing was, you know, believe it or not, it had something to do with it, because I grew up in a country in Iran where dancing was banned, and I loved dancing, and I could not even attend a dance class because it was outlawed, and so, you know, being in a country where those kind of civil rights are respected, where, you know, you can work hard and that pays dividends, that was a big value for me.
Interesting. And in dancing, how did that become such a big part of your life?
Do you know what? I've been asked that question before, but it was something, you know, my mother says that I was dancing before even I was born. And I think she's right, because I always, you know, if you saw any videos of me, you know, growing up, I'm always dancing, whether there's a music playing in the background or not. And it's, you know, it's just too unfortunate that I didn't get to train formally until I was in my mid-20s or late-20s, so I never was able to pursue that. But if I had grown up in a place where I would have had access to training, I would have probably ended up being a dancer.
Great. You are obviously extremely busy. Do you have a chance to read anything outside of schoolwork at all? And if so, what are you currently reading?
I do, and I tend to switch back and forth between books, but there are a couple of books that are on my bedside right now that I'm reading. One of them is called Prisoner of Tehran. Tehran is the capital city of Iran, and it's a memoir by Marina Nemat, who spent some time in the Iranian prison and then immigrated to the West. The other book is Team of Rivals, and that's history of Abraham Lincoln's leadership and how he started off with the rivals that he started off with and managed to make allies out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two books that I'm looking at, and sort of every time, sometime before bedtime, I find that's one of the ways when you've had a long, long day, it's one of the ways that helps you flush out everything out of your mind by reading a book.
Definitely. If we could arrange for you to have 1 hour of lunch, because you're a busy guy, you don't have much more time than an hour, and we could, through magic, make that lunch happen with any historic or contemporary figure or person, who would, and this lunch would be, really the purpose would be to talk and learn about leadership, who would that person be, and what would you want to take away from the experience?
You know, given the book that I was recently reading and I was thinking about this question, I think it would be Lincoln. And I'd want to ask him, you know, how did you make allies out of your rivals?
You know, I really want to say thank you for taking your time to spend some time with us and talk about leadership. It's a great conversation, and I'm going to go back to it. I really liked your answer to, creativity and linking dance and creativity with the role that you currently are in at UBC. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's just a beautiful connection. I really do. I think that's just awesome. And congratulations on everything you've accomplished. I mean, you are a testament to an individual who made a great big life change and just really took everything from that opportunity. And you're making it happen. So I have great respect for that, and really thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely, it was a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we go, actually, is there anything we should that you haven't told us about leadership that we should know through your life, through your experience? Is there any lessons we can learn that we haven't asked you about?
I can't think of anything else. No, I think you've definitely asked me a lot, and I pretty much spoke from heart and just sort of told you whatever came to mind. So I hope that's useful. But if there's anything else that you need from me, please be my guest, because I do respect the work that you're doing in communicating these things to everyone else and creating that environment where people can hear what somebody up there in Canada is doing. I think that's great that you're providing that ability. And you know, I'm a big fan of your book, and I've shared it with our senior HR manager, and we are going to look at how we might incorporate some of that in our orientation for next year's executives, because I think emotional intelligence is I think one of the really, really important pieces when you deal with such passionate group of people coming in to lead.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Bijan.
Truly, you're a very impressive guy, and we really appreciate you spending time and sharing your experiences with us.
What is your password? Your password has been accepted.
Plugged into a stream of real-time data. A cyborg soldier. A techno warrior. Computer. All connected to the World Wide Web.
Personal cybernetic technology. Personal cybernetic.
Pioneering the computerized lifestyle. The World Wide Web. The World Wide Web.
Hi, this is Wally Bach. I'm here to point you to this week's top leadership posts from the Independent Business Blogs. Our first post is from Sean Murphy. He points out that we often get caught in a situation where we make achieving our goals the most important thing there is. That's not necessarily bad unless it turns into an obsession. But Sean's got some ideas about how to keep that from happening. Now, if you're a boss, your attitude is contagious. It affects your whole team. Positive or negative, whatever you feel, they get. Mike Myatt lays out the reasons why it's important you tend your own attitude before you tackle the attitudes of others. Keith Olbermann has a long history of burning bridges, breaking rules, and blowing off superiors. He also has a lot of ability. Now, what would you do if you had an employee like that? Scott Eblen has some ideas that may help. Our fourth post this week is from a blog whose title I just love, Alpha Mayor. Laura Hunter uses her understanding of how you increase the odds that horses will do what you want them to do in order to give you some ideas about how you can get a similar result with humans. My final pick this week is by Gwen Teatro on the relationship component of making the move from individual contributor to boss. If you know someone who's making that transition, you'll want them to read this post. You might even want to read it yourself. Now, every week, I've got a challenge of the week to get you thinking. This week, think about the transition from individual contributor to boss. What advice would you share with someone in that situation? And how would that advice help you right now? If you'd like to see more of my writing, I do most of my blogging at 3-Star Leadership. That's where I try to help bosses at all levels do a better job and lead a better life. I also join others blogging about talent development at Results Versus Activities. And at Toolbox for HR, my blog is titled People and the Changing Workplace. You'll find links for all of them on the Weekly Leader site. I'm also on Twitter, and I'll be back here next week.
Initiating shutdown sequence.
Hi, this is Valerie.
And John.
From the Nushis Orchestra, and we are proud to be PodSafe artists.
Please tell me you'll never have to say goodbye. I can't wait,
baby.
This is what I've been waiting for. Ooh, I can't wait,
baby,
till my love walks in the door. No, 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 I can't wait,
baby.
True love is so
wait.
Hard to find. I found yours, you found mine. I can't wait,
baby.
Tell me what is on your mind. I can't wait.
I can't wait.